Commentator Ben Matlin doesn't mind sharing his hopes for the new year.
For me, this new year is as much about looking back as looking ahead. I turned 47 in the past year, which in itself is miraculous, actually. I was born with a neurological nuisance called spinal muscular atrophy. It gradually and relentlessly weakens muscles. In my case, this weakening began at 6 months old. About half of the babies with SMA symptoms die before age two. Their hearts and lungs become too weak to go on. I was one of the lucky ones. I've used a wheelchair my whole life. I no longer have the strength to hold a pencil. Am I still one of the lucky ones? I believe I am. So why do so many people feel sorry for me? They don't know I grew up in a good family, graduated from Harvard, get my writing published, have a wife and two terrific girls. There are a lot of reasons I consider myself lucky. Still, people have said to me, if I were like you, I'd kill myself. This is supposed to be a compliment, I think. They mean to commend my perseverance. So how come I want to say back, if I were like you, I'd want to kill myself, too? Yes, there are people in terrible circumstances with painful illnesses who do want to die. But there are also many others who live in conditions I wouldn't trade for my own, such as famine, war, abject poverty. Yet they retain a stubborn sense of hope and struggle on. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a modern-day Tiny Tim trying to cheer everybody up. I reject holding myself up as an example of the triumph of the human spirit. At home, I kvetch and grouse all the time. It runs in the family. Plus, life is rough. Like 2 years ago, I spent most of 2008 in a hospital bed. An infection required emergency surgery. Then, something went wrong under the knife. I nearly died. But here I am. So yes, I do feel lucky. 2009 wasn't anything special, but it was blessedly drama-free, and that's enough to make it a good year. Sure, I hope for better in the new year, but even if I don't get that, I'd still say I'm lucky, because sometimes just normal is good enough.
Commentary from Ben Matlin, a writer in Los Angeles who's working on a memoir. You can comment on his essay on our opinion page at npr.org.
The way America teaches its teachers is under fire. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has been leading the charge with a series of speeches calling for education schools to reinvent themselves.
The programs are heavy on educational theory and too light on developing core area knowledge and clinical training under the supervision of master teachers.
Duncan says it's crucial to change now as schools prepare to replace a wave of retiring baby boomer teachers. NPR's Larry Abramson reports on one university trying to rebuild its teacher training program by taking a page from doctors.
Deborah Ball says most professions are clearly defined. We know, she says, what a lawyer or a doctor has to be able to do. Same for a plumber or a hairdresser.
We expect people to be reliably able to carry out that work, and we don't seem to have that same level of either expectation or requirement around teaching.
As dean of the education school at the University of Michigan, Ball is trying to change that. She and her faculty have taken apart their training program and then reassembled it, trying to figure out what skills teachers really need. The Teacher Education Initiative, as their overhaul is known, will cut the number of classes students must take, and it will turn time in the classroom into an experience that is tightly focused on problem solving.
imagine the difference between learning about child development, which is unquestionably helpful, and learning how to have a sensible interaction with a child which permits you to know exactly what's going wrong right now with that child's reading, or why is this error occurring over and over again in the math. That's actually being able to do something with that knowledge.
Stress what teachers have to do, not simply what they have to know. Professor Robert Bain says when the effort is finished, the education program will no longer be a series of courses students have to take,
but rather a program that's building on these experiences, much again like most professional schools, like a good med school or a law school.
So the university has picked up an idea from med school, rounds.
Is it possible for the readings to be about the same length?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
You can see the idea in action at North Middle School in Belleville, Michigan. Teacher Steve Hudock is talking to four University of Michigan student teachers before 7th and 8th graders arrive for a class on comparative religion. This is one of several schools these budding teachers will visit as they learn to analyze various teaching problems in different settings. Here, it's how to deal with students in small groups. Professor Bob Bain says before class, he demonstrated how the teachers in training might approach this challenge.
What their job is to practice the experience with actual students, but then also looking to see how Mr. Hudock, a skilled teacher, does exactly the same sorts of things. Then on Thursday, they'll debrief.
I see a connection between Buddhism and Shintoism. What connection do we see here?
Teacher in training Stephanie Smith is leading a group of six students trying to understand the relationship of Shintoism to Buddhism in Japan.
That's great, Marquise. So
student teacher Katie Weston says when she compares notes with teaching students in other programs, she notices a big difference.
We take on more of an interactive role, I think, than some of the other programs do, because we actually lead lessons and we get to work with the students in group activities like the one we're doing today.
Once the class is over, the group sits down with Hudock and talks in a focused way. What worked? What didn't? Steve Hudock says this is a lot different than the student teaching experience he had 15 years ago.
I set up my own experiences, contacted teachers, sat and observed on the sideline. I didn't really get to interact with students.
There's a good reason the folks at the University of Michigan are making these changes. Their very reason for being has been called into question. Some studies have shown that teachers who get on-the-job training do about as well as those who went to teachers' colleges. Dean Deborah Ball says training programs need to show they can do a better job of equipping the huge number of teachers needed in the coming years.
What we need to be more responsible about is not just the recruitment problem, which I think is important, but the training problem, what we equip people with before they do it.
The medical rounds model is a popular one among education reformers, but it is clearly a lot of work, and it requires plenty of coordination to move students in and out of different schools. It may be difficult to scale this model up to train the 250,000 new teachers who graduate every year. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we begin a look at the way small changes can make a big difference in your life. And that includes small changes in the lives of two men who are genetically the same, even though their routines are not. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on the significance of 1 hour of basketball per week.
We'll get to the hoops in a minute, but first I want to introduce you to identical twins Tim and Paul Daly. They've shared a lot in their 60 years, a childhood bedroom, an identical set of genes, including some that predispose them to diabetes, and of course, the same birthday.
February 16th, 1949. And God bless my mother, she somehow dealt with us over the years, right?
Been known as the Daly Double ever since.
And yes, there's a story about which one is older.
Paul came out first. He's the oldest by 30 seconds.
I won the fight between the twins.
No. I pushed him out. I definitely pushed him out. He won the fight.
He tried to strangle me, Allison. He had the cord around my neck.
Competitive, yes, but each other's greatest defender, too.
You get into scuffles as you're growing up.
Paul remembers one courtyard scrap from 50 years ago. A game of stickball turned nasty when a neighborhood bully showed up.
And this kid's on top of me, basically wailing away, and I look over looking for Tim. Where the heck is he?
As soon as the person would get on top of my brother, I'd jump in. We took care of each other.
In addition to defending each other, Paul and Tim played basketball together. They joined the army together, learned to love German beer together, and through all of this, they weighed 147 pounds. Almost everything about them was the same until 1974, when life began to take them in different directions.
Probably, you know, the separation started when we met the women we were going to marry, right. And that's when you start to separate a little bit.
So you settled in two different towns outside Boston.
That's correct.
Tim's dream was to start a business, which he did. First a video store, now real estate. Paul wanted a little more security. He built a career in IT. Both started families. Paul says his wife is an excellent cook, and they liked the Irish meat and potato style dinner.
So there's one major difference, because you were eating maybe a little more pasta and I was eating a little more potatoes. But in those days, my wife worked nights and I worked days, so I would tend to eat probably not what I was supposed to be eating. And the weight over years came up.
Both brothers gained weight in their 30s and 40s. It's just that Paul was putting it on faster. He wasn't getting regular exercise compared to Tim, who kept up with basketball. He played every Tuesday night with a group of friends. Paul says a photo from 1996 was a wake-up call.
I looked at the picture and I said, oh my God. So I went from 185 to 220 pounds, which blew my mind because I didn't think of myself at 220 pounds.
And he certainly didn't think diabetes, a disease that tracks closely with obesity. But during his annual physical that year, at age 47, Paul was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. He hadn't experienced any symptoms other than feeling thirsty, which is typical.
When you first get diagnosed, it's like a punch in the stomach.
What terrified him was the ugly list of complications that result when diabetes isn't well managed. Here's physician David Nathan of Massachusetts General Hospital.
The complications include loss of vision, kidney failure, amputations because of an effect on the nervous system, and then also an increase, a really substantial increase, in heart disease and stroke.
And here's the scary part for Tim Daly. His brother's diagnosis meant he was almost certain to develop diabetes too.
Because we know that type 2 diabetes is a genetic disease, and since he has an identical twin, he has a risk of developing diabetes that's about 95%.
But 14 years after his brother's diagnosis, Tim still does not have diabetes, and he doesn't take any medicine to keep his blood sugar down. So how does he do it? Is it something of a small miracle? Not exactly, says David Nathan.
It's not that different than many of our other patients.
The patients Nathan's referring to have all gotten on board with a big national study that's documenting exactly what it takes in terms of changing everyday lifestyle habits to prevent type 2 diabetes. It focuses on eating less and exercising more, a strategy that's easy to say but tough to follow.
Can you imagine telling someone you can never have another potato chip as long as you or another French fry? It's like, people will give up right away.
That's Tim Daly again. As you might imagine, he wasn't stoked about giving up the foods he loved or this weekly beer and pizza night with his buddies. But back in 1996, he jumped at the chance to take part in the prevention study because he knew how high his risk was. And a test showed his blood sugar was already higher than normal. He was pre-diabetic.
Does that motivate you or what? Because I'm the twin. So if I'm getting close, I gotta get refocused.
To Daly's surprise, the changes he needed to make were not as drastic as he feared. Here's how David Nathan describes it.
This was not a diet. What we try to do was to teach people to change their behaviors.
During his first meeting with nutritionist Linda Delahanty, Daly weighed in at 200 pounds, too much for his 5'10" frame. So she gave him two specific goals.
He needed to lose 14 pounds, and he needed to reach a target of exercising for 150 minutes per week.
The Tuesday night basketball accounted for the first 60 minutes. To step it up, Tim added in some walks and jogging, a couple of miles a few times a week. When I caught up with him just before snow hit, he was out golfing, walking the course, instead of riding in a cart with his buddies.
What do you think? What do you think of the yardage, huh?
He says it's good exercise.
Oh! That's a heck of a shot, Tom.
He says people who don't play golf don't get it.
You hit a little white ball and chase it around. No, you come out with your buddies. You have fun, talk about just life in general, and enjoy the beautiful scenery. We just saw five deer on the fourth hole.
And by the time the round was over, he had walked several miles. Daly says learning to do more exercise in the course of a week was not half as challenging as learning to eat small portions all the time. But he's learned to make that a habit, too. For instance, he knows the rule of thumb on portions of meat. They should be no bigger than a deck of cards. And what about chips?
Yeah, I can have some potato chips, but I don't take the bag with me. I pour a bit into a cup. That's what I have.
Over time, all of these small changes led to something more significant than just losing the weight.
Losing that 14 pounds actually caused his blood sugars to revert to the normal range from the pre-diabetes range.
Wow, this must be a big surprise to lots of your patients that such a subtle difference can be the dividing line between diabetes or not.
Right. I think that's what people don't realize. They think they need to lose 50 pounds or 100 pounds.
But in this case, just 14 pounds made the difference. Here again is David Nathan.
Small steps can result in these really large benefits downstream. Just doing a little bit more will help enormously to reverse this. And that's what the Diabetes Prevention Program actually showed.
Nathan says the Daily Twins are not an anomaly. Though Paul is living with diabetes, by stepping up his level of exercise and eating better, he's been able to manage the condition and doesn't need to take insulin. The brothers say nothing has changed since the days when they were defending each other from a playground bully.
We have that special bond, and we are truly, truly blessed.
So you're fighting diabetes together.
Yes.
Yep. And we're going to win it.
It's the kind of attitude that makes David Nathan hopeful.
You know, we have 1.6 million new cases of diabetes per year in the U.S. now. And, you know, we could conceivably over a decade even decrease that by a third. That would be spectacular.
As Nathan sees it, an epidemic could be reversed if lots and lots of people worked to make small changes. Alice Naubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Facebook has unveiled a new system of privacy settings along with some recommendations for users. The millions of users now have more options in deciding who can and can't see details of their accounts. But critics say the social networking site is actually trying to push people into sharing even more personal information. NPR's Martin Kosty reports.
Michael Zimmer is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who specializes in online privacy. He welcomes the new Facebook privacy controls, sort of.
I always appreciate that they're giving more control. The challenge is that sometimes it looks like you're sitting in the cockpit of a 747.
Zimmer says the sheer complexity of the new options may cause many people to just give up and accept the recommended settings, which Facebook has helpfully pre-selected. The thing is, those recommended settings usually make an account more public.
We think this is unfair and deceptive.
Mark Rotenberg is head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, a group that's leading a campaign to get the Federal Trade Commission to investigate Facebook's privacy practices.
So we are trying to get the Federal Trade Commission to enter the 21st century to begin to think about companies that are operating online and what their obligations are in terms of fairness and openness.
Last month, EPIC sent a letter of complaint to the FTC. It cited numerous examples of what Rotenberg sees as Facebook maneuvering users into being more public. And Facebook is actually removing the choice of keeping certain kinds of information private, such as a user's fan pages, which could provide clues about someone's likes and dislikes to outside search engines. Facebook says this is all just a false controversy.
It's almost astounding that people are complaining instead of lauding Facebook.
Tim Sparapani used to work for the ACLU. Now he's Facebook's director of public policy. As a former privacy activist, he says he's impressed by how much his new company has done to enhance users' control over their data.
This is the fulfillment of 40 years of work by privacy advocates.
Sparapani says Facebook is the first big company that's ever listened to what privacy groups want and implemented progressive data management principles.
Notice, choice, access by users, transparency about what's happening with data, and control given to users of their data held by companies. We believe that we have actually managed to make those things operational.
And Sparapani says the fact that certain important privacy groups have not signed on to the letter of complaint indicates that they agree with him, that they see Facebook's new privacy controls as a victory. One of the groups he cites is the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Kevin Bankston is EFF's senior staff attorney, and he says, not so fast.
I don't think that Mr. Sparapani has been reading our blog post carefully enough.
Bankston says the EFF didn't sign on to the letter simply because it doesn't have expertise with the FTC, and not because it sees the new Facebook privacy options as a victory.
Certainly, we give credit to Facebook for forcing its users for the first time to grapple with their privacy settings. But as we made clear in our other statements, we're very concerned by the incredibly broad defaults that the so-called transition tool is pushing on users.
The FTC is under no obligation to act on this letter of complaint. Still, it has shown more interest recently in matters of online privacy, and at least one of the new commissioners nominated by President Obama is thought to be a strong consumer privacy advocate. Back at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Mike Zimmer says the company is feeling the heat.
People have described this as sort of Facebook's Microsoft moment, where they become the new target.
No matter how many privacy options the site offers, Zimmer says, it's hard to escape the fact that information sharing is what makes Facebook users valuable to marketers, and the company has a powerful financial incentive to discourage its users from becoming too private. Martin Costi, NPR News.
As soon as films learned how to speak, they just had to sing. From the very first talkie in 1927 all the way through the 1970s, the musical lit up the silver screen.
Goodbye. Meet me in St. Louis.
I'm singing in the rain.
That's entertainment.
Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
Such great stuff. But in the 80s and 90s, the film musical basically disappeared. That all changed this past decade. Think Hairspray, Chicago, Mamma Mia, Dreamgirls, also Sweeney Todd, Phantom of the Opera. And fittingly, one of the last movie releases of the decade was a musical, Nine. Our film critic, Bob Mondello, joins us once again to take a look back at the decade gone by. Hello, Bob.
It is good to be here.
All right, so before we get to these past 10 years, tell us, why was there such a drop-off? Why just a handful of movie musicals in the 80s and 90s?
Well, because the ones at the very beginning of the 80s were terrible, which helps a little bit.
Get off to a bad start, yeah.
My theory is, if you think about it, in 1980-81, mm-hmm. this other thing happened. We started watching music in a different form, music videos.
MTV.
On TV, exactly. And so I think that because we had this other way to look at it, it wasn't necessary to have the whole long thing with stories.
But what happened? Because you're saying these type musicals made a big comeback in the last 10 years. Well, we still have music videos out there today.
Right. But there was something that happened in Hollywood, which was that they made this little musical called Moulin Rouge, and it made lots of money. That was in 2001, and it was a story set in 1899 with Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman. Mm-hmm. And Ewan McGregor was writing a musical, and as you will hear, I'm about to play a clip, he was not entirely in period.
All you need is love.
A girl has got to eat.
All you need is love.
She'll end up on the street.
All you need is love.
Love is just a game.
I was made for loving you, baby. You were made for loving me.
Isn't that nice? I mean, it was really kind of fun what they were doing with it. They used a whole bunch of other songs, big hit songs, and turned it into a lovely collection of music videos, in a sense. And it was big and splashy and gorgeous, and the audience bought it.
Gorgeous to watch, and that kind of opened the floodgates, or we could put it, après Moulin Rouge, le déluge.
Yes. And a lot of those pictures, the ones you mentioned at the very beginning, went over the $100 million mark. And that's really what's different about this decade. These pictures are grossing enormous amounts.
Huge box office.
Right, and especially Mamma Mia.
The ABBA musical that
That's
had been
right.
a huge hit on stage.
Which grossed more than $600 million.
Whoa, Mamma Mia, here I go again. My, how can I resist ya?
Man, I wish I could have resisted that one. That drove me crazy that was that big a hit. Because it's by no means one of the great musicals to come along. But it is, I mean, it was very popular. And audiences all over the world loved ABBA and therefore loved that show.
And a few of this genre, of the film musical genre, have been actually good movies. You could name Chicago, for example, which actually won the Academy Award for Best Picture a few years back.
That's right, in 2002. And it was the first one to win in that category since Oliver had in 1968. So we'd had a long, dry spell about all of that.
Hold on, hon, we're gonna bunny hug. I bought some aspirin down at United Drug. In case you shake apart and want a brand new start to do that.
Why do you think these film musicals are making a revival?
Well, the theory usually put forward about why musicals stopped being popular was that audiences just felt uncomfortable with the fact of people bursting into song all the time. And I was thinking about it, and I think in around 2001, 2002, people started walking around on the subway, at least here, singing.
iPods.
And it's iPods. Huh. And I suddenly realized, oh, how weird. And I think it is that we got used to the idea that we have a soundtrack in our heads as we're walking around. And so it didn't seem so strange for characters to have that.
I don't know you, but I want you.
There was one musical that actually took that idea and sort of ran with it. It was about a couple of musicians in Ireland, and they decided that they were going to try to put together a song. And one of them recorded the music onto a tape.
Oh, I'm remembering this. This is Once It Was Called.
That's right.
Right.
And he gave the tape to his girlfriend, and she put on headphones, and she's coming up with the lyrics, and so she's walking down the street wearing the headphones, listening to the music, and she's singing.
Take this sinking boat and port it home. We've still got time.
So it makes perfectly good sense, even if you're a stickler for realism, that they would be singing like that.
This is obviously easier done with a film that's about music, a little bit harder if you're doing a movie about, I don't know, a musical about Wall Street or something.
Yes, that's true. Let's hope they don't come up with a musical about Wall Street.
Gordon Gekko sings and dances. Well, last question for you, Bob. Mm-hmm. Is this a trend we're going to see continue?
Oh, yeah. Actually, this coming summer, they're remaking Footloose. Hairspray 2 is coming along. Emma Thompson, I read, was working on a new script for My Fair Lady. And they're talking about Keira Knightley as Eliza. So we're going to see a bunch of stuff. And actually, there's a whole bunch of others that are in theory coming along, like Carousel and Aida and The Color Purple and Wicked and Sunset Boulevard. It's going to be another musical decade.
Movie critic Bob Mondello, who's been reviewing the decade in film for us these past few weeks. It has been a lot of fun. I know Guy has had a lot of fun, and I am so lucky to be able to sit in for the grand finale. Bob, thank you.
It's always a pleasure.
And we'd like to hear from you. What was your favorite movie musical from the past 10 years? Join the conversation at npr.org.
Speaking of jobs, 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 economists warned us that job growth was likely to lag behind as we came out of the recession. That is small consolation for millions of unemployed people. From the White House to the Congress to the Employment Office, everyone is looking for jobs.
The issue of jobs, 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 jobs has been our mantra. Jobs.
Saving money and energy, creating clean energy jobs that can't be outsourced.
It's kind of like a full-time job, just trying to find one.
Stimulus bill's not working. The American people are asking, where are the jobs?
This week in our series, New Jobs for a New Decade, we're going to look at which industries and occupations offer the best hope for creating jobs in the new decade. NPR's John Itzde begins our coverage with a top 10 list for job seekers.
The first decade of this century ended in a disaster for employment. Since the recession began 2 years ago, the U.S. has lost more than 7 million jobs. Just to regain the jobs we've lost will be a huge challenge, says Harvard University labor economist Lawrence Katz.
We would need well over 300,000 a month for sort of 4 years in a row just to try to make up what we've lost the last couple of years.
Katz says there are very few periods in U.S. history when job growth has been that strong.
So we're in a very deep hole. A normal recovery will not get us there for a very long time.
Katz thinks it could take half a decade or so just to get to the employment levels we had 2 years ago. Still, he expects during this new decade, the U.S. economy will eventually create 15 million new jobs, with the unemployment rate falling to around 5%. The real question, he says, is what kind of jobs they'll be.
The worrisome trend has been something that I've called the polarization of the labor market.
That is, strong job growth for the high-paying jobs and the low-paying jobs at both ends of the labor market, but less growth in the middle to replace the well-paying manufacturing jobs the U.S. is losing. That's what the U.S. has experienced in the past 15 years or so. And projections for the next decade from the Bureau of Labor Statistics suggest that elements of that basic trend will continue.
The top 10 registered nurses would be first, followed by home health aides.
BLS Assistant Commissioner Dixie Summers is reciting a list of the 10 occupations the BLS expects will provide the greatest number of new jobs over the next decade. Number three on the list, customer service representatives. Then comes
food preparation and serving workers, personal and home care aides. These, again, are folks who go into the home to help individuals, but they're not doing health care.
Retail salespersons are number six, followed by office clerks. So six of the top seven fastest-growing occupations are low-skill, low-wage jobs. Lawrence Katz says the challenge is to move those jobs up the skills ladder. There's no reason, he says, that home health care workers couldn't be better educated to provide patients with greater value and, as a result, command higher wages to improve their own living standards.
So professionalizing those types of jobs, we could have a very optimistic vision of an economy.
How that might square with the goal of spending less on health care isn't clear. Katz argues it wouldn't necessarily require spending more on education, but rather changing what's taught to focus more on different skills, like problem solving, interpersonal relations, and teamwork. Once again this decade, the BLS is projecting the healthcare sector will be a leader in producing new jobs, 4 million of them, including high-skill, high-paying jobs like doctors and nurses. The service sector, which includes healthcare, is expected to produce a whopping 96% of all new jobs, while manufacturing employment continues to shrink. For job seekers, BLS Assistant Commissioner Summers says nursing combines a huge number of openings with high pay, a median wage of over $62,000 a year.
Accountants is another one that's expected to grow pretty rapidly and pays around $59,000 on an annual average.
For those who want to spend less time in school than accountants and nurses but still make good money, Summers suggests firefighting or becoming a sales rep for a manufacturer, especially one making technical and scientific products.
That group, the sales representatives, is around $70,000 a year.
Finally, over the next decade, the best-paying, fast-growing job that requires little training is truck driving. According to the BLS, the folks driving the big tractor-trailer rigs earn, on average, about $37,000 a year. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
Our series, New Jobs for a New Decade, continues all week. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.